It's 7 o'clock. Welcome to Thursday Night Talk. Tonight, Jana Valakovic is our host. As always, we welcome your contributions. However, we do have two guests calling in tonight, and our lines are full. Therefore, we're only accepting text messages tonight, so give us a text at 492-KHSU. That's 707-492-5478.
Good evening. Welcome to Thursday Night Talk. This is Jana Valakovic. As Michael said, I'm your host for tonight's show. For my day job, I work for the University of California in the Cooperative Extension Program in the Eureka office. Well, 2017 was quite a year for wildfire, with the North Bay fires and the Thomas fire in particular. And now we're dealing with a car fire in the Redding area, the Mendocino complex, the Ferguson fires outside of Yosemite. So 2018 is off and running to become another record setter. And the 2018 fire season is long from finished. In thinking about it, more than a third of Lake County has burned over the last 3 years. Smoke, falling ash, road closures, and evacuations are all affecting everyone. You know, I want to just preface this show today to say, with, you know, the degree of media attention, the heart-wrenching stories are circulating, and most of us have probably had many more moments of disbelief that these fires could move so quickly and so many people could be caught in the middle. So I want to share that all of us on the show tonight extend our heartfelt sympathies to everyone who's been affected, and to share that we're here to offer support. But listening to these media shows and their review of the fire of the last month, we've heard stories about record-setting fires, fires capable of making their own weather, crazy fire tornadoes, and then quite a bit of discussion about these fires being fed by climate change. So what's the real scoop on these issues? To answer that question, I've brought in three very talented scientists to help us unpack these and other issues. And I know we've got a couple of them coming in on the line and one in the studio. So Eric Knapp is a research ecologist with a specialty in fire and fuels. He works for the Forest Service Research Station in Redding and joins us by phone. And Eric, I can imagine that your perspectives may be changing now that you're living in a community that's so directly affected by fire. Welcome.
Thanks, Jana.
All right. Glad to have you here. Also joining us in the studio is Eamon Engber. He's a fire ecologist who works for several national parks and the Forest Service. He's stationed out of the Redwood National Park office in Oreck, and his responsibilities include Whiskeytown National Park, Oregon Caves, Redwood National Park, and the Six Rivers National Forest. I know tonight he's speaking personally as an ecologist, but I'm really grateful you've been able to catch, you know, get away and help us out tonight.
Thanks, Jana. Happy to be here.
Okay. And I believe we have Craig Clements, who's a fire meteorologist from San Jose State University, and he runs the Fire Weather Research Lab. He joined us by phone. Are you there, Craig?
Yeah, I'm here.
All right. Great. Welcome, you guys. So thank you for joining me and for agreeing to come on to Crazy Live Radio. As we get started, I was wondering if each of you can give a bit more information about what you do. So, Eric, what's a research ecologist, and what do they get to do for the Forest Service?
Well, I study a range of things, mostly fire ecology, fuel management, forest ecology, and I'm particularly interested in the interaction between fire and ecosystems and how that's changed over time, from when fire was once more frequent in our ecosystems to what it is today. And
Great.
So I also do quite a bit of work with prescribed fire.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. And Craig, what's a fire meteorologist?
Well, basically, I study fire-atmosphere interactions, how fire behavior is driven by small-scale weather patterns and large-scale weather patterns, and also how wildfires can create their own weather.
Oh, that's pretty cool. You're like a fire weather chaser, maybe?
We do. We operate a mobile atmospheric profiling system that's actually listed as a national resource for fire agencies, and I believe we're the only meteorological team in Ross with fire line qualifications.
That's pretty cool. And Eamon, what do you do as a fire ecologist? What does that mean?
So thanks again for having me on, Jana. My position is really a blended position between fire research and ecology, as well as applied implementation. So During the summers, I typically do a lot of fire effects monitoring of our fuels treatment projects that are designed to meet the land management objectives for our agencies. And then I also do wildland fire response. And so depending on the year, I might spend a little bit of time off the parks or a lot of time. And this year I've spent almost a month over on the car fire. So it's a little more applied than Eric's position, but does require a good amount of research throughout the year on fire ecology and fire effects.
Great. Well, I think we've got the right team today. So for tonight's discussion, I'd like to approach the issue with some exploration of whether or not the last calendar year reflects a new normal for California. Each of you have had direct experiences with a car fire, so I thought we could use it as the subject for our discussion, though I can imagine that our conversation will be applicable to fires throughout California. And I'm hoping we'll end this show with some thought about how we might be able to change the trajectory and perhaps become more fire-adapted, whatever that exactly means. But it should be a fun discussion. I'm imagining that many of the listeners have heard quite a bit about the car fire. There's been a lot of media attention on this particular fire. I think it might be helpful for those that maybe don't have the storyline to help us kind of narrate a little bit through it. I was thinking that we could kind of explore a bit about why it was difficult to control, why it got so big, and you know, I'm expecting that the weather conditions are a big part of this particular story. So I don't know if it's an opening for Craig first or Eamon, but maybe you could help us set the stage a little bit about the event itself.
Well, if you want, Yana, Eamon here, I could just go over the sequence of events.
Okay.
And then after that, we could dig deeper into the
okay,
some
great.
Of the causes and trends.
Yeah.
So for those who don't know, the car fire was discovered on July 23rd at about 1 in the afternoon on Whiskeytown National Recreation Area, right off of Highway 299 near Carr Powerhouse Road. It was aggressively attacked initially, had a full suppression response, and then it quickly grew north out of the park. So by the 24th of July, it was a few thousand acres. Fire behavior was moderate. It was mostly driven by topography and fuels. We didn't have strong winds on it yet. West winds began picking up on the evening of the 25th. Fire behavior picked up, and those couple days, the temperatures in Redding were around 113 degrees, which was significant because it tied the record for the day in terms of high temperature. So following that weather trend and increased winds, we really had explosive growth during the evenings of the 26th, the 27th, and to some extent the 28th. 200-foot flame lengths were observed. It was primarily driven by weather and topography, I would say, at that point. There was an ellipse shape to the fire, wind-driven. It was in steep terrain, burning in shrub fuels, and it made it into the urban interface of West Redding. So it ended up burning over close to 1,100 homes, 3 firefighter fatalities, 4 civilian fatalities, ultimately the 6th most destructive wildfire in California history, and it got up to somewhere around 230,000 acres and is close to full containment now.
Okay.
So that's the short story.
Great. And so you were part of that firefighter response team, Eamon?
Yeah, I came in on day 3 in this fire when it really began picking up, and stayed there for 2 weeks, took a few days off, and then came back later. But yeah, I was there for the first night, and you could actively see the, you know, multi-100-foot flame lengths burning from a mile out.
Wow.
That was impressive.
So, Eric or Craig, you each had a connection to this fire, too. Are there pieces to add in terms of setting the stage for this fire or describing some of the sequence that you think is particularly notable?
This is Craig. I think I'll make a mention on the weather. It was, like Eamon said, it was fairly benign on the start, but on the 26th of July, that was that Thursday evening where the big rotating column occurred, and that was quite unique in terms of fire behavior and also in like terms of fire weather conditions. So as the wind picked up, that really drove that fire down into the canyon there and across the river up. And if you've seen the videos, it was that's what we consider extreme fire behavior, with the spread rates and the fire front moving around the circulation. And we can talk about that in a little bit more detail later.
And you were able to dispatch to this event too?
We came up late. we came up for two separate days, but it was mostly for smoke monitoring. And then we came back to help part of the investigation on looking at the debris field of where the tornado went through.
Okay, great. And how about you, Eric?
Well, I wasn't actually on the fire, but I had obviously a front row seat to it. I was at a friend's house in one of the neighborhoods that got hit pretty hard, Lake Redding, along the river. I was just having pizza and hanging out with friends, and then we were there at her house because we expected she might have to evacuate, and then it sort of came to fruition. I was there when the fire crossed the river and headed up and produced that fire vortex. So I could see it from a little more of a distance, but I ended up just trying to stay behind and protect my friend's house and her neighborhood from a fire, you know, just using garden hoses.
Did you eventually leave?
I left, yes. Since I wasn't on an engine or anything, I just did what I could, and I got out when things looked like they were turning for the worse. You know, embers were raining down. My friend's front yard caught on fire, and I figured it was time to go.
I hate to ask the question, but did her house make it?
Her house did. I was very lucky. We put a fair amount of effort into, you know, watering down her roof, taking care of her gutters, removing stuff from around the house, but neighbors on three sides burned down. So it was a bit of luck, but also I think what we did may have helped out.
Right, right. Okay, so this, you know, what is this? Was this fire expected? Was it anticipated in some sense of planning? What was the vegetation like that the fire ignited in and burned through to bring it to Eric's neighborhood?
Well, it was it's a very complex fuel type. I mean, like Eamon was saying, it's a lot of shrubs mixed with oaks, foothill or sometimes called digger pine, some ponderosa pine, but it was just a very complex fuels. A lot of that area hadn't had a history of recent fire, the area west of Whiskeytown. So it's, you know, been a century or more without fire. And so, you know, over time, a lot of these shrubs, they're parts of them die back, and you have a lot of dead fuel mixed in. Kind of a problem waiting to happen, as I saw it. When I moved to Redding 14 years ago, I always liked the looks of the west side there. But knowing a bit about fire, I decided not to live there. So I never looked for a house in that area. Just because you could see that, you know, something like this was a possibility.
I can chime in, Eric, on top of that. You know, I think it is a really hazardous fuel type. There's tall shrubs, and it's intermixed with very steep topography, especially on the north side of Whiskeytown Lake. But you do have to understand that the overall car fire, it burned in a very diverse range of vegetation types, from almost subalpine on the top of Shasta Bali at 6,000 feet down to the northwestern Central Valley at close to 500 feet. So it really spanned a great range in fuel types. And there's some climate story there as well in terms of the fuels, because, you know, we had a lot of wet rains, late season rains in 2018. And so as you move from the more chaparral-covered slopes on the north side of Whiskeytown Lake down toward Redding, there was a pretty good fine fuel crop as well in there. And given the extreme heat and dry conditions, fire danger indices were around 97th percentile levels and beyond on some of those days. Very receptive fuel beds as well. So it still exceeded my expectations as far as being a fire ecologist working at Whiskey Town and seeing the aftermath of some of 2008, which did burn some of the shrub-dominated communities on the north side of the lake. This by far exceeded that. But like Eric said, it's not totally unexpected fire behavior, but it was still impressive. And I think it was hard to stay ahead of for those two or three days.
You used the term fine fuel communities, fine fuel creation. Can you define that?
Yeah, so when we talk about fuels, and we're talking about live and dead vegetation, and so the fine fuels are referring to those fuels that are very small in diameter, and those could be grasses, forbs, small diameter shrubs, as well as things like leaves and sticks that are less than a quarter inch in diameter. So you often hear fire people talk about 1 hour fuels, and those are very reactive to changing atmospheric conditions. And so they wet quickly, but they dry quickly. And they don't take much to achieve ignition temperatures because they're so small and have a lot of surface area to volume.
Okay. Great. So if you're just joining us, you're listening to Thursday Night Talk. I'm Jana Valakovic, and we're talking about wildfire and community preparedness. My guests are Craig Clements, who's a fire meteorologist, Eamon Engber, fire ecologist with Whiskey Town National Park, and Eric Knapp, a fire ecologist with the Forest Service. We're talking about a subject that's close to everyone's, I think, attention right now, and I think the lessons learned are going to take a while to kind of become evident. And I think there's a lot of folks, you know, trying to find answers and potentially trying to figure out if there's some way that we could prevent such activities, damaging wildfires from occurring. So, you know, part of this story is about fuels, I would assume. And so, Eamon, I know that you at Whiskey Town and that the park in general has been working on, you know, fuels management prior to the fire. And I guess you should set the stage by a good portion of Whiskey Town National Park burned, right, in this event.
That's correct. Almost the whole park. I mean, the fire perimeter exceeds the boundary of Whiskey Town. 42,000 acres is the park, and we estimate it burned maybe 39,000 of those, understanding that part of that is a lake. So most of the park burned.
Is this the first time that we've had almost an entire national park burn?
As far as I know, it is. I could be surprised, but I can't think of any cases where a whole park is burned. And granted, it's not the largest park in the Pacific West region, but it's still a significant event for Whiskey Town. And you asked about the history of fuels treatments at Whiskey Town, and we have been a pretty active park in terms of our fuels management program. 2008 was also a fairly large year. Since about 2005, we've had almost 20% of the park burn. So an impressive portion has burned. I think, you know, one of the big differences that we see with this fire, the car fire in 2008, is that this was a human-caused ignition that started at the bottom of the slope off of Highway 299. 2008 was lightning-caused. It started on upper slopes, and there are some pretty big differences in fire severity in terms of much higher fire severity for the car fire compared to the lightning ignitions in 2008 that backed down. But Whiskey Town also, in addition to the wildland fire history, we have a number of fuels treatments. And since 2013, in about the last 5 years, we've treated almost 1,700 acres along the boundaries of Whiskey Town with prescribed fire, in addition to some mechanical treatments where we thin small diameter trees and pile and burn those. These were pretty extreme conditions, obviously, that the car fire was burning under. And some of these fuels treatments really aren't designed to slow or even to stop a fire under those conditions. But given those conditions, there were quite a few surprises, actually, in that 2 to 3 of our recent fuels treatments on the east side of the park along the Shasta Divide, as well as the west side of the park in the higher elevations, did really well during this fire. And those did not necessarily burn during the peak of fire spread, which was on the north side of the lake. But even under those very dry conditions with slightly less wind, we saw a lot of moderate fire severity and really beneficial fire effects in these fuels treatments in areas that had been burned within the last 3 to 5 years.
So when you say did really well, does that mean that the resulting effect was better, or does that mean also that the fire behavior changed and it perhaps changed the flame lengths or some other element of how the fire was burning when it hit those areas that have been treated?
Yeah, all of the above. So, you know, fuels treatments are really designed to moderate fire behavior, to slow fire spread, but not necessarily to stop fire. And so I think one thing we really need to understand with the car fire is that with all fires that we actively suppress, life and property are the number one priorities. And so when we had West Redding on fire, essentially, or being actively burned into, that was a priority for fire resources. So we had a number of fuels treatments at Whiskeytown that the fire just burned through. And had it been a smaller fire under less extreme conditions, we may have been able to get boots on the ground to actually hold the fire in some of those locations. Given just the nature of this event and the adjacency to the wildland-urban interface of a very large community, we didn't have those boots on the ground. And so, or we may have had them, but they were focused on other things at the time.
Right.
But that said, there were still benefits of these treatments in terms of increasing the level of survival of the residual vegetation in those stands. So we might see a high-severity stand where 75 to 100% of the trees died. That's what I would consider high severity. And we had some cases where there were high severity stands directly adjacent to stands that we had just treated within the last 3 years with prescribed fire, where the levels of fire intensity in terms of the crown scorch on the trees was fairly high, but it was not a raging crown fire. It dropped to the ground and burned through the understory in these fuels treatments. And there were 2 to 3 examples of that, which are pretty neat. And it's still early phase, you know, so we're actively going out and doing the fuels treatment effectiveness monitoring right now. We've got a crew on the ground from Pacific Northwest Research Station, and over the next 2 years, we're going to be pursuing a number of different research projects to really get a handle on what was effective, what wasn't, and what the limitations are in some of these fuels treatments.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about wildfire, primarily the car fire out of Redding, and this is Thursday Night Talk. We're limited tonight to text for your questions, and that's 492-KHSU or 492-5478. Eamon Engber from Whiskeytown National Monument Area was just sharing some information about how the fire behaved in the park where there were some fuel treatments. And Eamon, you gave me a few photos to post up, and those are on the KHSU website, and they're on the front page right now. They'll be later under the Thursday Night Talk section of the web. And I think those photos illustrate some of what you're talking about, where you had, you know, active fire behavior that scorched the crowns, and then places where you still have green parts of the tree still visible.
Slightly green, but yeah, those examples that we put on the website are from this, what we call the Boulder Creek Project, and it's in the vicinity of Boulder Creek in the park. And it was an oak woodland mixed conifer thinning unit where we actually commercially harvested trees and did follow-up pile burning. And the images that we posted, you can see there's a road in the center of the image, and on the left side of the frame was untreated, and you can see it was crown fire because all the needles and leaves are consumed on the trees. And then you look across the road to the right where the treatment is, and the crowns are still intact. There was still a significant heat blast that occurred because it was a relatively narrow, I think it was about 200 to 300 foot wide treatment. But the photos do show that it substantially moderated fire behavior in there. So hopefully some of those older growth, mature black oaks and sugar pines survive in there. That's yet to be seen.
All right. Sounds like we've got a future location for some field trips, don't we?
Certainly.
So I'd like to shift gears a little bit. You know, going through and digesting what the media tended to fixate on, one of the stories we kept hearing was that a fire can create its own weather, and then there was an amazing set of images that have been floating around. One was, I think, taken from a helicopter, and one was from the ground of this rotating column, this fire tornado. So, Craig, can you talk to us about that feature and how common it is, and whether we should have gotten super fascinated by it as an anomaly, or whether it's more common than we think, and you know, sort of a bit about what the impact was of that column.
Yeah, I mean, rotating columns on fires are not uncommon. If you look back at the Eiler fire of 2014 near Bernie, that had a rotating column that had a blowdown where it knocked down a lot of timber, and so pretty strong winds as well associated locally with the circulation. The Indians fire, I think that was 2008, that had a rotating column as well. What's unique about the Carr fire incident is that it was extremely strong. It's equivalent to an EF, enhanced Fujita scale tornado. So that's like 140, 150 mile an hour winds. And we believe, the meteorological community, the fire weather community, believes that this is probably the strongest fire-induced tornado on record. And so that's why it's unique.
Wow. And so what does it look like where that tornado went through? I assume it touched down?
Yeah. Well, it doesn't touch down. It actually, it's different. So fire, so there's a lot of nomenclature.
Okay.
That we have to define. So generally the fire community calls these fire whirls. Fire whirls are very, they can be fairly benign. You see them a lot. They're very common on fire fronts. It's where the combustion gases or the fire zone or combustion zone is actually spiraling up. And so these circulations generate from generally the surface up. What was unique about the Carr fire was that the plume, the entire plume, was rotating very deep into the atmosphere. It was picked up on three different radars. A colleague of mine at the University of Nevada, Reno, Dr. Neil Rowe, did an initial radar analysis of that on the night of the 26th and showed that, yes, indeed, this thing was rotating. The Sacramento Weather Service, I believe, mentioned this in the forecast, or like kind of in a nowcast in the afternoon, said, hey, the column's rotating. We're seeing it in our radar signature. So that was pretty unique to be able to see that in the radar signatures. So fire whirls are generally smaller scale. We call them fire vortices or a rotating column. But this incident was so strong that people are calling it a tornado, and because it has the effect. If you looked at the ground, I went and was able to survey some of the damage. And so there was the gas line that was wrapped around a tree. All the trees, all the bark was stripped on all the trees. All the soil was removed. And so the bark is stripped from some of the sandblasting from the soil and just from the force of the wind. There was a sea container that was ripped. The high power line structure was basically bent over and transported by the wind hundreds of yards. And even that, most of the steel bracing from that tower was wrapped around trees. So the force alone makes this a little bit more unique than your standard rotating column.
Hmm. How wide, how long is that impact zone?
I can't recall. Eric might be able to, I think he might be able to comment on this. I think he went up there, Eric. I think it's, the duration was unique as well. Comment on that. It was a long duration, over an hour, that it was rotating. But some people are considering that maybe there was multiple circulations versus just one large circulation, but we haven't really seen a lot of that in the public, the video sources from the public. So it could have been multiple vortices that were moving through the region or just one large one. The radar signature seems like it might be just one. I think it was close to a kilometer, maybe a kilometer and a half wide, and the debris field was at least 2-3 kilometers long.
I think Hollywood's got a new future film coming, Attack of the Fire Whirl. Sorry, I'm trying to make light of the situation. It's very, very terrible. But
and Craig, correct me if I'm wrong, but the ambient weather conditions, I mean, there was a strong west wind, but it, it, it wasn't anywhere near, you know, tornado speed winds, right? I mean, if I recall, the predicted weather was gusts somewhere around 30 miles per hour maximum out of the west going down into the Central Valley. And so, I mean, how much did that, the weather and the day of burn atmosphere affect the progression of that phenomenon versus just the extreme amount of fuels burning, the intensity, the steepness of slopes, or the alignment of topography? Can you comment on that?
Yeah, so I've been looking at the weather stations for that afternoon, and winds were gusting to 30 on the ridges, about 25.
That's what I thought.
So that's not that strong. The sustained winds were 10 to 15 in the upwind of West Redding. So that's not that significant. But again, the ROS network in the region is not that dense. And so you could still have some gap winds that are generated down the canyons. I mean, even, what is it, Whiskey Town headquarters number 2, that station was showing pretty benign wind through the evening. That could have, I don't know if that's actually, and gusting very light. Of course, the fuel moistures on some of these sites were down in the 3% for the 10-hour fuels. Relative humidity was in single digits in the afternoon, increasing to about 10%. So, I mean, the fire spread was there. I mean, the conditions for extreme fire spread were there, but the wind really wasn't that strong in this region, but it was kind of dusting on the mountaintops. And I haven't done a thorough analysis, but I did talk to the meteorologist at the GAC, and they said that what's unique about this region, and those of you that are up there know this, but you get a gap wind, and we get this down here in the Bay Area as well, but what happens is we're closer to the Pacific Ocean, so we get moist air. What we call vecting in, it's like moist air blown in by the sea breeze. What happens up in that region is you have dry air over the interior mountain basins, and the forcing from the heat, the low, there's a what we call an inverted trough or a heat trough in the valley, that sucks all that air in. Before the cooler marine air can reach the mountains or reach into Redding, you get that real dry air that's at higher altitude, so that descends, dries further, and warms further. And so that doesn't help. Generally, a sea breeze, even though the winds increase, it's associated with high humidity, so that can actually help firefighters. But in this case, you're inducting drier air. So that could have been, I think it's local scale meteorology, alignment terrain. Something happened where potentially with a fire line, maybe got into a classic L shape. Generally, what we consider fire wheel formation is a bend in the fire front. If you get a sharp bend, you can actually induce circulation alone just from the heat flux. And so that can start the circulation up.
Wow.
It was kind of fascinating, too, how the extreme fire behavior really picked up in the late afternoon and evening, and then it just burned deep into the night, into the morning hours.
Mm-hmm.
That seemed to be one of the unique factors as well, in addition to that fire tornado forming, but it was happening overnight. And I think that presented one of the big challenges as well for people getting out of the way and being able to see what was going on.
Right. That's a perfect segue. So we're looking for answers. The media, the public, residents, whether it's this fire or many fires, and I guess, Eric, we haven't heard from you for a little bit. What do you think's going on? Is this the new normal?
In our group of fire communicators, we've been debating this term, new normal, and I totally understand what is meant by it. I think it can be a useful term, but I like to think of it more as our current reality, and whether it's new normal or current reality, it's maybe splitting hairs. But when you think about it, new, you can ask yourself, well, is what we're seeing right now new? As Craig said, there have been fire vortices in past fires. We forget that in 1999, the Jones Fire in East Reading burned 954 homes. So this seems to happen, you know, over and over. But there's definitely some things that, you know, there's some trends that look new, you know, like the Mendocino Complex, largest fire in California history, on top of the Thomas Fire last December became, you know, that was then became the largest fire in California history. So we keep on getting larger fire sizes. That seems like increasing home losses. And this expanding length of the fire season, you know, that might be considered, you know, part of the new territory. And then the other part of the word, you know, whether it's this is a new normal, to me, the word normal sounds like we're maybe kind of resigned or accepting of this new condition. It's almost as if nothing can be done about it. And maybe that's just my own way of looking at the word normal. And maybe it's because I'm a rebel and don't like things about don't like the term normal. But and the reason why I don't like the word normal is I really don't feel like it has to be this way. Like in many cases, it's within our power to do something about it. For example, land use planning that considers fire hazard zones or managing fuels. You know, for example, if the surface fuel is treated, like what Eamon was talking about with prescribed fire, that particular location, it won't burn for a while, maybe a number of years, no matter how hot and dry it is. You know, so it is possible to buffer our landscapes against the effects of global warming. So, you know, I just hesitate to normalize this something that we have some control over. If that makes sense.
Yeah. No. I think it's a really legitimate question to think about resigning ourselves to a certain set of conditions or recognizing that we're all a part of the outcome that we want to achieve and setting our course for what that outcome could be. So if you're just joining us, this is Jana Valakovic. I'm your host of Thursday Night Talk, and we're talking about wildfire and communities and preparedness. My guests are Craig Clements, who's a fire meteorologist, Eamon Engber, who's a fire ecologist, and Eric Knapp, who's also a fire ecologist. We welcome your texts at 492-KHSU or 492-5478. Craig or Eamon, do you want to add on to that question about the new normal or leave it where Eric left it?
Yeah, I could tie into that. I like what Eric said, and I think the important part of this puzzle is your frame of reference. So I actually pulled a few statistics from the National Interagency Fire Center this afternoon, and I think a lot of our frame of reference comes from the last 30 or 40 years. And so since about 1980, we have seen some increasing trends in acres burns and costs nationally as well as regionally. But just to throw a couple stats out there, if we look at federal acres burned from 1985 to 95, it was about 3 million acres per year on average. 95 to 2005 is about 5 million acres per year. 2005 to 2015, about 7 million acres per year annually. And in 2015, we hit 10 million. In 2017, we hit 10 million again. So just looking at those numbers since about 1980, we are obviously seeing an increase in that trend. But the historical context is very important as well. There's a pretty neat research paper from 2007 by Scott Stevens at UC Berkeley, and he looked at historic fire regimes and the amount of acres burned that would maintain certain vegetation types that we see today. And they estimated that just in California prior to 1800, about 4.5 million acres per year would burn in California alone. So that's about the same as that decade between 1995 and 2005. But, you know, so maybe the acres burned isn't unprecedented, and it depends on our frame of reference, but we're obviously more vulnerable now. We've got urban interface communities that abut fairly hazardous fuel profiles in the state, and on top of that, you have increasing temperatures, longer fire seasons. Tony Westerling at UC Merced's done a lot of work on that, and we've had about a 30-day increase in the fire season in the western U.S. So there are some confounding factors, but it doesn't mean that we can't do anything about it. And we've got lots of examples within the research community as well as just the local management community where fuels treatments are effective. And it just depends on the vegetation type and how time since recent burn, time since treatment, and obviously the conditions under which the wildfires burn. But we're not helpless in this scenario.
Right. Thank you. Some good perspectives. Craig, do you have anything to add into this?
Well, I get asked a lot of questions about climate change as a meteorologist on some of these things, and you can't blame climate change on you can't blame every wildfire on climate change. I mean, and this happens a lot, especially with the Car Fire tornado. If it was, and a lot of media jumped on to climate change causing fire tornadoes. No, it's heat flux, wind shear, complex terrain. These things occur in all places around California. If that was the case, we would have had 19 fire tornadoes in 1 week because these are microbiological aspects. However, climate change is affecting the fuel. So if you look at the fire behavior triangle, you've got topography, fuel, and weather. Weather is the most rapid changing. You know, seconds, minutes, hours, days. Fuels change seasonally and also hourly based on the fuel moisture content and stuff. And topography. California has all of that. So we basically have lots of problems here. We're not just the flat plains out in the grasslands where we have big fires there too. We have big mountains. Fires spread very quickly upslope. And so it's a complicated problem. But and climate is basically a factor on the fuel, in my opinion. A question I have for the fire ecologist is, what are the fuel loadings out here? I mean, are they much higher historically now than they were historically, or is this something kind of benign?
Well, this is Eric. I could say something about that. This area has an interesting history, and a lot of the areas to the west of Shasta Lake and a little bit to the south and west of Redding were affected by copper smelters and pretty much denuded of vegetation around the turn of the 20th century. And we have some pictures in our office from about 1900 to the 1930s where there's little growing on those hills. But, you know, as the acidity of the soil waned, that vegetation grew back really vigorously, and you know, a lot of it is like I were talking about earlier in the show. There's a lot of dead stuff mixed in, a lot of shrubs, and some pretty volatile fuel types, knobcone pine, which burns hot, a lot of species that came in with that disturbance. And historically, this area would probably have burned fairly frequently. It also gets a huge amount of rain. Like this area, some of it may get 60 or more inches of rain a year. And so it grows fuel, and then it gets really, really hot, and that fuel dries out. So I'm guessing that in the long-term absence of fire and that to set that vegetation back, I'm guessing in many areas, especially where the Car Fire came down that night, the Thursday night, the 26th, and burned into Redding, the fuel loading was considerably in excess of what it would have been historically.
Yeah, I'd agree with Eric on that. And I might just add to that, Eric, that, you know, there was a portion of the north side of Whiskeydown Lake in that area where the fire blew up. It moved through the 2008 Motion Fire. And anecdotally, just looking at those slopes, you know, a month after that burn went through that area, there's quite a bit of survival. There's a decent amount of green in there of young knobcone pines that regenerated in 2008. So I wouldn't be surprised if conditions were moderated somewhat in that Motion Fire footprint, but because it was plume dominated and it was spotting, you know, a mile ahead of the flaming front, it moved well beyond that footprint and kept on going. But within it certainly made some difference, and that was about a 10-year interval. And, you know, just to provide a little bit more context, the larger Car Fire, it did burn through a substantial amount of mixed conifer forest that had not burned probably since the early 20th century. So there were some areas with elevated fuel loadings for sure, but maybe less so down in those mixed shrub and pine communities.
Hmm. So we've talked a little bit about climate. We've talked some about this not being entirely driven by climate. So what do you think some of the pathways are for us to get out of this period of high fire activity? Or maybe is there not a pathway? And I guess just musing a little bit on this topic. I mean, Eamon, you were talking about these increases in the amount of area that has been burned over the last several decades, and that also corresponds to our increasing, you know, average temperature in California as well as in the continental United States. So, you know, how does that play into this discussion? So, how, you know, are there pathways for us to try and turn this ship around?
I think so. That's why I come to work every day. But, you know, I think you need to be context specific in terms of the vegetation and the relative hazards associated with fire behavior. And I know at Whiskeytown, these areas that are shrub dominated, they typically burn with stand replacement fire. They don't have an overstory canopy, or if they do, they're scattered knob cone pines. And those areas are somewhat less receptive to fuels treatments than areas that do have a canopy or are more have more of a conifer component. And so the fuels dollars we get at Whiskeytown, we've primarily focused on those areas where we can do more with our money in terms of changing the fuel profile and reducing the hazard. And so that's part of it, is being strategic about where we do fuels treatments. And then the other part of that is being strategic about where we develop. And that's certainly not my area of expertise, but there's a lot of urban interface in California that's adjacent to fairly hazardous fuel profiles. And so I think part of it is managing the fuel, and part of it is working on better strategies for where we're building homes. And then also some of the home hardening stuff that's also outside of my area, but I know, Yana, you have experience working with home hardening, and that's a huge piece to the puzzle as well.
Yeah, there's a lot to add to this. We've got two callers who've patiently texted their comments in. So for those of you that are on the line, why don't we think about that question of what we can do, and then also listen to what these calls are and see if we can kind of weave it together in our last 15 minutes here.
Okay, so yeah, we had two callers off air, and they called in their questions. You can still do so at 826-4805. We just can't get you onto the show, but I can take your question and write it down. But the preferred method is texting. So with that being said, this first question is from Jack, and he kind of touched on the topic of fire suppression throughout history, and how that's kind of, you know, allowed fuels to grow and remain uncontrolled and cause further fires in the future. And he said that kind of started with a big fire in the Midwest in the early 1900s called the Big Burn that killed quite a few people and kind of added to the stigma of fires and not wanting to do controlled burns and just wanting to suppress them altogether. And the second question is bit of an not quite related to that topic, but this one's from Johnny Mack, and he says, or he asks, what kind of conditions would need to occur here on the North Coast prior to a fire event like what happened in Redding?
Okay, great. Thank you, callers, for those great questions and great comments there. So why don't I don't know, Eric? Do you want to talk a little bit about this history of fire suppression and how that's affected our current condition, and then maybe we can bring it home with Johnny Mack's question about the possibility and likelihood of this occurring in Humboldt County?
Well, I mean, that is indeed part of the puzzle, is when you put out most fires, I mean, that allows fuels to grow and without it would have otherwise been set back and reduced, and dead wood consumed, that dry fire behavior. So, the longer you go without fire, usually the more intense the subsequent fire is. And I think we're finding now that it is, it's possible to control a lot of fires, even with these high fuel loads, under moderate conditions. But under the more extreme conditions, like what we just saw in the car fire, all bets are off. It's very, very difficult to control, and a lot of that is due to this legacy of trying to put out all fires.
Okay, great. So, Eamon, you're probably best positioned to answer the question from Johnny Mack about what conditions would be required to set us up in Humboldt.
Yeah. well, we obviously have a more coastal climate here in Humboldt County, although on the eastern edges we get more of that inland influence. I think that there have been some hot fires in the history of Humboldt County, and they happen less frequently, perhaps. But I know even with my drive daily between McKinleyville and Oreck, there's a few patches of redwood snags east of Trinidad. And I've talked to some of the old firefighters, and they said, oh, yeah, there was a fire in the 1950s that burned right up to town. And there's some debate about whether that was logging slash related or weather related. But it's a little bit of an unknown. I think typically in the fall, we get more of our north and east wind events that are dry with low relative humidities. Typically, the strength or the magnitude of those events are not conducive to the type of fire behavior that we saw on the Carr fire. But we're not a fuel-limited system. There's a huge amount of fuel loading in our coastal forests, and it's more of a moisture-limited system. And so I'd say looking into the future, that's where things like climate change or just the prevalence of individual east wind events, kind of like we saw in the North Bay fires last year. I have questions about whether or not those types of conditions will set up more frequently and at a higher magnitude or not. But yeah, that's something maybe Craig could comment on better than I could.
Well, and let me just intersect one thought here. We're getting close to the end of the show, and that is that last year I hosted another one of these radio shows on fire, and we were talking about the Chetco Bar fire, which is a fire that happened in Brookings, and it started in the mountains, and it had the right conditions that set up, and it blew pretty close to the town of Brookings, which is right on the Oregon Coast Range. So we've had some fires in recent past that have a signature that we could experience. I think one of the previous guests from that show talked about, you know, crew availability. And so when we've got a receptive set of conditions for fire, so does the rest of the state. And we just hope that the rest of the state's not on fire at the same time, because it's hard to dispatch resources everywhere simultaneously, as we've just seen. So I know we've got another text that's just come in.
Yes, we do. One second. If a state organization does not have the resources or the will to reduce accumulated fuel loads adjacent to private dwellings, what are a landowner's options?
Oh, that's a great question. Do any of you want to tackle that one, or do you want me to give some thought to that? Okay. I recently was at a conference where this topic came up, and the recommendation generally is to reach out to the owner of that public property or the manager of that public property and start a conversation and talk about what your concerns are. Usually you'll find a receptive group that will be willing to talk through those pieces. Another component, and this is a great way to bring in what's going on with the Humboldt County Fire Safe Council, they're building a community wildfire protection plan, which is open for public comment right now. Comment closes September 28th, and it's a great way for the community to express their interests, and so perhaps the community of concern could try and work with the County Fire Safe Council, and if they don't find a receptive audience with their neighbors, can help to put that in writing and in documentation into that general overall plan for the county. Every county goes through a community wildfire protection planning, so it's not unique to Humboldt. So if you're interested in that community wildfire protection plan, you can find it at humboldtgov.org and / Fire Safe Council or / fire plan public. So there's some some ways to get your issues and concerns highlighted. And then there's also assistance programs that can help landowners themselves with being able to manage fuels, and those can come through federal agencies like the Natural Resources Conservation Service or through CAL FIRE. As well as some of the Fire Safe Councils sometimes have funds. There's a program here in Humboldt called the FLASH, the Fire Adapted Landscapes and Safe Homes Program, or something to that effect, which is another way to get some assistance dollars. I think it's really about communities working together and identifying their risks and identifying their opportunities and how they may be able to manage those risks. You know, as we wrap this show up, I'd like to think about sort of overall concluding thoughts about forest and community resilience, and you know, how do we plan for better communities? How do we plan for forests and landscapes that can receive fire on a regular basis? Any of you have any thoughts on that topic?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I just think this is also an opportunity. I mean, in a lot of places, we're starting from a clean slate, and I think it's our just excellent firefighting infrastructure. I think it's kind of gotten us used to not having to think a whole lot about the possibility that a wildfire might actually impact us. So I wonder, you know, if we could change our thinking a little bit, you know, maybe accepting fire, and if we accept it's going to happen, would we be more willing to put in a little extra work to prepare or pay a little bit more for fire-resistant materials? I guess I'm hoping the answer is yes going forward.
Yeah, you know, I think my piece to this this solution is just that having an increased understanding of the vegetation and the role of fire in it in the state. It's very diverse, but when you have an understanding of fire ecology, it can really give you some hope, because for one, you understand what the role of these fuels treatments can be and how beneficial they can be. But it also helps you understand the resilience of some of our plant communities. And I know there's a lot of people who've driven through 299 and looked at the slopes above Whiskeytown Lake in the last couple weeks and have just felt devastated. And I feel that way too about portions of that fire. But there's a lot to be gained from this event in terms of how we can learn from it. And I think people will be quite surprised when they see the vegetation response, especially in those lower elevation plant communities outside of Redding, you know, the shrub dominated and the foothill pine and the knobcone pine. Those areas come back really well. They typically burn hot when they burn, and we saw that in 2008. And as far as the vegetation piece, you know, not all is lost, and having that understanding of fire, fire behavior and fire ecology can really give us some hope.
Craig, do you have anything to add in there, or can I ask you, what do you wish the public knew about fire meteorologists that we don't know?
Well, I think that to follow on with those comments is that the public needs to be aware that with climate change and potential for longer droughts, I mean, we came out of a five-year drought. We have a lot of mortality in the forest, and so we have to expect that conditions could get worse in terms of the climate footprint on fuel. So I think people have to be aware of that fire weather and wildfires are California's severe natural disaster. It's our severe weather, and so I think everybody has to be aware of the conditions during the fire season, which is becoming longer and longer.
I've been, some of my colleagues have been saying, and I find this quite useful, is that we've somehow developed a culture that we fight fires, yet we don't fight earthquakes, and we don't fight hurricanes, and we don't fight tornadoes. We instead adapt, and we build our communities to be resilient to them to the best of our abilities. We engineer, you know, strength into our buildings so that they can handle the shaking and the torquing in the buildings. We, you know, engineer safe places to be during tornadoes. We design our buildings to withstand the wind loads of hurricanes. Yet for some reason, culturally, we think we can fight fire as opposed to work with it and think about how we can engineer some greater resistance into our human structures.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Jana. And just to tie into that, too, I mean, it is kind of unique about fire that we do have the opportunity to also focus on, you know, the energy or the food that feeds it, which is the fuel side. And so we don't want to just focus on that, but it gives us more options when we come to the table. And I think focusing on the engineering side as well, like we do with some of these other natural phenomena or disasters, as they're sometimes called, will really help overall with our fire environment and our response in California.
Yeah. Well, I think that's about wraps us up. I want to thank all of you for joining us on this show and really for your amazing leadership on these challenging issues. If any of the listeners would like some more information, we've posted a few items and some useful links on the Thursday Night Talk webpage, which is a part of the khsu.org webpage. And I, you know, just want to express my appreciation to Craig Clements, fire meteorologist, and Eamon Engber, fire ecologist, and Eric Knapp, fire ecologist, for joining in and for